Welcome to the Cinephile Hissy Fit Podcast, brought to you by the Ruminations Radio Network and sponsored by Plymouth Festival. This is the tirade-filled movie debate hosted by two film critics, cool dads, and struggling teachers. I'm Don Shanahan.
And I have the same haircut as Ripley in this movie. Ooh, William Johnson.
You are sporting the shaved look. I did see the painted shaved look the other day when you were a drummer in a band. Nice.
We're not going to get into that. But speaking of shaved heads, I think since we're talking about, I'll just spoil it for everybody, even though it says it on the name of the episode. We're talking about Alien 3. I think this Sigourney Weaver shaved head look was a pre-puberty sexual awakening for me, to be honest with you.
That's a spicy one. Good call, man.
Yeah, because, so 92, I was 10. I had not started, like, finding my way to sneaking in movies I shouldn't be watching. I remember the most rebellious thing I did at that point in time, probably 9, 10 years old, was I called my mom to make sure it was okay that I watched Robot Jocks, which was PG-13 at my friend's house. So 10, I think the most I would get away with is looking at cool poster art or going to the video store and checking the backs of boxes. And that was as rebellious as it got. And Alien 3 poster was incredible because it's an alien movie. It's the third alien movie. And they don't need to put an alien on that thing. They just had Sigourney Weaver looking badass with the shaved head, looking like she's about to fuck you up. And it just says Alien 3 on it. Like, there's no aliens. There's no floating heads. It's just Sigourney Weaver being a badass, which is shows her star power at the time. But yeah, I've kind of dig the shaved head look. And it probably goes down to some kind of primordial prepubescent seeing Sigourney Weaver look so intimidating and hot that I just stuck with me.
Yeah. 20 years later, how do you feel about like Charlize Theron in Mad Max Fury Road? Is that she match that look and vibe for you?
No. The shaved head look has always done something for me. And like I said, it's probably it probably goes back to the poster of Alien 3. I mean, it really does.
Because
this was, as much as people like to deride this movie, as much as David Fincher pretends it doesn't exist, there are some images from this movie, including the bald head look, and also probably the most, probably one of the most iconic shots in the entire franchise.
I agree.
When she's crying against the wall and the alien is sniffing her out.
That's right.
You know, it just, her bald head was so just everywhere in 92. At 10 years old, I still remember, you know, the video stores, the posters, the commercials. It was just such an iconic look, you know, and it had an effect on me in many ways. So
that'll work. Boing. On that note, ladies and gentlemen, we're damn glad to have you folks for this love fest of all things baldness. This is all for tantrum's sake. We're sure passions and high fives to wash away any plates for hate. No matter what, we encourage you all to love what you love. But for now, the gloves are off and the hiss of it is on. For those of you who follow the show, we've been working on an alien quadrilogy watch here, where we're like kind of a reassessment, where Will's the expert. I'm the guy coming back to him like, all right, let me try these again and that whole thing. So we're on, as you heard, Alien 3. We're going to record a double tonight for behind the scenes purposes, where Resurrection is going to be in the can by the time we're done. So our format is this: the recommending lover is going to go first for all intents and purposes. That is the tour guide of the fan man. That is Will here. He will get 5 uninterrupted minutes to shower his praise and state a timeline and case why Alien 3 is deserves better than it does. The hater, which I guess is me more as the neophyte than the hater, is going to follow with 5 uninterrupted minutes of my own to present any counterpoints with any manner of intellectual scorched earth. After that, we'll open it up for about 30 minutes to share a conversation where the hits of it really gets chippy and interesting. So for this one, 3 times the suspense, 3 times the danger, 3 times the tear. Let's go.
Yeah, I mean, let me reemphasize before we get into the 5 minutes. This is what I said in the Alien show and the Alien show. And just in case someone's listening for the first time for this one, I hold Alien, Aliens, and Alien Resurrection. Mm-hmm. Like, I love them all basically equally. It's tough to pick for me. The common argument is always Alien or Aliens, but I throw Resurrection in there too, which we'll talk about next week. Alien 3 has always been one that has fascinated me as well. And I love it as well, but it's just not quite on the level. But as we'll probably discuss, it's not from any fault of the creators, more so the producers in the studio. But would you like me as the lover to go first? And
absolutely. Please do. Preach.
Got it. Let me set my timer so I don't go too much over. All right. Yes, Alien 3. Now, I'll talk about this in both episodes, and I'll try to spread it out between both because I think it applies to both Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection and even Aliens itself. Everything that people complain about Hollywood today, these Alien movies did, especially 3 and Resurrection, did what the people are whining about today. And the only problem is that people are still whining about 3 and Resurrection, despite the fact that 20 years later, 25 years later, whatever, it defied what the standard studio system is and what the standard franchise development is. You know, the interesting thing about, we'll focus on 3 for this particular 5 minutes, but the interesting thing is when Alien came out as kind of a horror haunted house hybrid, you know, the producers wanted James Cameron and they let James Cameron make a James Cameron film, and he made a different film. He didn't try to make a copy of Alien. He made his own Aliens film, and Aliens is completely, I mean, not completely, but a very different movie than Alien. And Alien 3, it follows the same idea. They were like, you know what? We're really into these, we want to kind of have this. This is right before the indie boom, but right around this time was also big for like music video directors and things like that. So the producers did get somebody maybe that would bring a fresh eye to this franchise, but also did at least, you know, in the final stages, because there was like, if anyone's ever seen the amazing documentary, it's longer than this movie. You know, the amount of drafts and different stories and different writers that went into this. When they finally, you know, let Fincher do his thing, he at least started to do his own thing, you know, and they wanted to do just like Aliens did for Alien, create something completely different. If Aliens is kind of this gung-ho military flick, you know, action flick thriller, you know, the creators purposely went back and said, hey, let's not even have guns in this thing. They decided to take a risk and tell a completely different story. Now, obviously, it's well documented, even to the point where the director, David Fincher, barely even acknowledges this film because he had such a miserable time. But, you know, there was something kind of bold and innovative about this film because it is so drastically different from the one that came before, while still, in my opinion, honoring what came before. Another thing that a lot of people like to complain about, and actually a friend of the show and frequent guest and co-host at one point for our live show, Ben Callimer, you know, he said, hey, please don't tell me, when he saw I was rewatching this, he was like, please don't tell me you're mad about Newton Hicks. And I said, no, I'm one of the few people that doesn't complain about that, because I think that's another risky thing this film did. It was like, hey, you liked these characters, and hey, guess what? They don't get to live, you know, and even worse, they die off screen in probably like the most brutal fashion possible. Hicks is impaled by a beam, and, you know, Newt drowns. I think it adds to the drama of it. It adds to this element of risk, because it's like, oh my God, you could end up liking some of the characters in this film and know that they are not safe. They're not plot safe. They do not have plot armor. Add to that the unique setting, the fact that we are kind of given a group of, I wouldn't say anti-heroes, because some of them are very bad people that are just going through some kind of cultural or social awakening, religious awakening. As flawed as it may end up being, I cannot stress enough how noble and I don't want to say brave, that sounds too serious for a movie, but just how this movie really went for it. And if it doesn't succeed, that's fine. And to quote Al Pacino in Any Given Sunday, you know, like, if you're gonna fuck up, do it big. I don't care. I'm not gonna eat your lunch if you if you try hard, you know, and that's, this is the thing. This movie tried really hard. In some cases it swung and missed, maybe not because of the, I mean, there's so much history to go into, maybe not because of the creatives, but perhaps the producers. But I think, as flawed as this is the type of film we should be celebrating more than putting down as a quote unquote lesser sequel to what is, in the end, two extremely classic movies, which is hard to replicate in itself.
Oh, where's my bell? There we go. There we go. No, I admit, I'm going to get in trouble with Ben Kallmer. I do lean to one of those people who I do miss Newton Hicks a little bit, or at least a, resolution wouldn't hurt. I do get where you're coming from. Well, now I'm not as married to it as you are, where I'm not a Alien diehard, you know, lover, where it's not a deal breaker for me by any means, but as a curious movie watcher, that is a bit of a bummer for me not to kind of carry that on. Cameron did such a good job of establishing what that was, where that could be. And I would have loved to see that dynamic play out further, where, you know, Ripley and a partner would protect a kid if they're stuck in a scenario again, kind of thing. Like I would have been down for that. Now at the same time, can I, completely applaud, like you said, the boldness and the bravery to just screw with an audience and just throw and swing hard? I can't. And I think Fincher this is baby Fincher here, but like, just, he is talented enough to make something look good, cut good, and move enough that despite all the studio interference and all that, there is a good movie in here somewhere. You and I both watched you told me the assembly cut of three here. So it's a little more lengthy, a little more fuller bodied. And I think it shows, and I'm happy to see that. Of the four we've watched, and like I said, I'm going to save some stuff for Resurrection 2. This is definitely easily number four. Which is fine, but I still gave it 3 out of 5 on Letterboxd, where it's a fine movie. You know, there's nothing bad about it. And compared to, like you have said in other shows and other places, like the science fiction action and the low stakes that we have so often today, in movies that are, you know, either overexplain with exposition, don't put a lot of stakes into things, but overexplain things to audiences, stay very almost PG-13. Like, this movie still has balls and boldness to just do some kills and do some stuff. It's not super creative. We'll get to that when we get to number four with Resurrection, where that does some of the weird stuff better. But you still got a taut, decent movie here that, yeah, maybe in 92 they weren't ready for it. Maybe after Terminator 2, this one felt in 91 being like such a super hard-edged yet immensely cool R-rated movie that this is a step down in terms of like style and panache and flash, at the same time brutality, where there's plenty of brutal things in this movie, but maybe not as like flashy as you see in other things of that era and time. But I was down for it. I mean, it's still the saving graces for me are the two Chucks. You got Charles S. Dutton, who does a great job as kind of a fake preacher of sorts, or a middle level leader who, you know, assumes that position out of more necessity than anything else. And then Charles Dance showing up and just being a cool, calm, and collected kind of character. Where at the same, you wonder as that beginning goes, like, is he in on this or not in on this? And you know, is it good doctor, bad doctor? And there's fun there. I think the movie takes a good little bit to get going. That first 40 minutes can be a little bit, not unlike the other two Alien movies we've had, where obviously you slow roll in the first one to kind of build to the monster. And then in the second one, there's a whole lot of, you know, Paul Reiser and Ripley kind of sorting out what they're going to do before they get to that planet. So that's kind of par for the course. And I'm ready for that at that point. But what helps this movie is exactly what you pointed out to start. This is still Sigourney Weaver at her peak, doing her best, being bold, being strong, being a screen presence. She just has it. It's a shame so few filmmakers have been, or so few roles have been able to give her this much meat to chew on than playing Ellen Ripley. She's a bona fide star, and I know she's got her great things like Working Girl and several other places where she's been wonderful, but like, I wish she had like one more part in her career that was, you know, that makes it goes to this legendary level where like, man, look what she can do. And luckily, as you said, with these movies being very standalone, each one of these movies that she's in gives her something else to be and do. It just happens to have the same character's name. So that's the fun part of watching Sigourney Weaver cook and work, is that she'll have range for anything you want her to do. And it, while still playing this character with the same, with some central principles, she's willing to challenge herself. Again, today, this would be somebody just playing to the greatest hits, you know, staying there one little jokey self and not a lot of range, not a lot of scope, not a lot of thought to just damage and trauma and all that. And she plays it. She plays it super well. And I'm always going to be impressed by Sigourney Weaver. All right. Hang tight, ladies and gents, and please enjoy this short announcement for the Ruminations Radio Network.
You've seen Twin Peaks all the way through, but all you have are spoiler-free discussions? At Blue Rose Task Force Podcast, no information is classified and nothing beats the listening sensation when production history collides with deep theory. Put the coffee on.
All right, welcome back.
Well, I have so many things I want to discuss.
Yeah.
The first one that you mentioned, and it's kind of ironic because I'm sitting here saying, like, I don't mind the killing of Newton Hicks
off screen.
However, I do feel that when this movie does potentially lose a lot of momentum, I'm actually in it. You were saying the first 40 is a little bit of a slog. I'm actually in it for the first hour or so. I actually enjoy the setup of the universe, the setup of the prison colony, the dynamics, the politics, the people.
Sure.
This movie kind of, I'm not going to say goes downhill, but loses its momentum for me when Charles Dance exits the picture.
I agree. Very
because true. It's similar to Alien, but it's something that wasn't needed. Like in Alien, we were playing with audience expectations. We were thinking, okay, Tom Skerritt is the hero and he dies first. That makes sense. We already know Ripley. I mean, despite the fact that this movie is taking risks, we kind of know that Ripley's going to get through at least to the part where she wins before she kills herself. So having a character that you can emotionally connect with, I really thought Charles Dance's character Clemens is probably one of my favorite characters in the franchise.
I agree.
He is layered, three-dimensional, tragic, funny. Like he's just, there's a lot of mystery to him that we learn a little bit, but there's still a lot of him we don't understand. We definitely want more, and I have no problem with him dying. I just think that the movie didn't have a great as Charles S. Dutton is. Uh-huh. He doesn't feel quite as, like, I guess what I'm saying is, like, in Aliens you kind of had Ripley and Hicks kind of had that duo thing going where they communicated without communicating. Like they just were on the same wavelength, you know? And I think Charles Dance's character of Clemens is the same thing. I think him and Sigourney Weaver had great chemistry. They kind of worked well together. They kind of had an unspoken language with each other. Charles Dutton is great, but he doesn't feel like a companion to Ripley. He just kind of like, and the problem is that second half of the movie after Clemens is dead, he kind of has to be that next teammate.
He does. Yes,
and as great as he is, it just doesn't have the same. Dylan feels more like that third. He feels more like the Bill Paxton kind of character.
Yeah,
in this, I agree. One that ends up being pushed to the front. It would be like if Hicks died and then suddenly, you know, Hudson is the, you know, suddenly the lead. But that being said, I think that. There's good stuff here. Now,
I agree. Yeah. It was interesting to read, just like I was just kind of doing the Wikipedia dive this morning, where just the number of scripts that this movie, you know, tried on for size and how they were going to try to figure this out. Like William Gibson wrote one in 87 that ran into a writer's strike and was going to be very Marxist with a space empire. Then like Rennie Harlan was approached and all that. And then, you know, it was going to be more space commies. And then you get to a script by Eric Red where it's more of like that one was kind of the crappiest one that they kind of threw up with the plot elements of, again, more Marines and the, you know, some of that stuff, small town America setting kind of thing. David Tui, who is an action specialist, also kind of took some Cold War analogies into some things. It goes in a lot of places. And Vincent Ward, who's his own filmmaker, you know, more of a romantic guy with the map of the human heart and would go on to do What Dreams May Come and stuff like that. He kind of brought it back down and he got the story credit in this movie where, again, you still got two TV puncher upwriters, and then Walter Hill kind of put the zing into it, where you could tell this is a mishmash of Cocktail Napkins. I think after that first 40 minutes, like, because I'm with you, like, even though it's not my favorite part of the movie, the establishment of characters and people, especially thanks to Charles Dance, helps a ton. After the shit hits the fan, it's like, all right, what's one way to get to here? What's one way to get to there? Oh, I got an idea for this. I got an idea for that. And it turns into Cocktail Napkins and Legal Pants. But I like Charles Dutton. I'm a Rudy guy, where Charles Dutton's,
sure,
he's going to work for me more than Charles Dance is going to work for me. But I see what you mean.
Well, the astounding thing to me, excuse me, and you'd never know this watching the movie, if you don't know anything about the history of Alien 3,
yeah,
you wouldn't know this, but like the crazy part is that they built those sets like before this particular iteration of the script was written. So like
the foundry and the prison and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, like, but before it was supposed to be a foundry and a prison, they had already built those sets. So like the fact that they were able to, because I can't remember whose draft it was. At one point, one of the drafts was, it was very cerebral. But at one point, one of the drafts was like, it was like a wood planet in space. And
oh, wow.
It was a planet made out of wood that essentially was a ship that I guess like these, and I'm sure there's hardcore fans out there that are going to yell at me if I get it wrong, but I'm just trying to go off memory here. But apparently it was like a wood ship planet, like it was out in space, and it was full of like monks and like this religious order that wanted to create their own.
Wow.
Whatever.
Yeah,
that religious aspect ended up staying, but I think they were originally building those sets to be part of like this wood planet. Like it was supposed to be this wooden, like,
yeah, interesting
gothic kind of thing. It's crazy. And they actually, in the documentary, I remember them showing them, they did like a speed, what do they call those things where they show the stuff happening in fast motion, like a progress over time thing of them building sets. But sure, like those sets were built not of the intention of what this film is. And then, so the fact that if you were watching this not knowing the history, you wouldn't know that. But it's just the fact that they literally had to try to adapt the ninth script to whatever sets were already built. And the other major issue with this one, and we see this a lot with franchise tentpole films these days too,
okay,
is that Alien 3 had a hard release date that was set before anything was done. They were like, you will release this on this day, on this date in this year. And everyone was like, well, fuck, we're running out of time.
They were the Memorial Day weekend hitter here. Yep, I understand. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and you mentioned about all the cooks in the oven or whatever the hell the fuck you said. I can't remember. Sorry. cooks in the kitchen. But yeah, and the other thing is one thing I think cinema history-wise, we have to remember with this. Believe it or not, this film was nominated for an Oscar for visual effects. That said, unlike some other films from the past that have mm-hmm. dated special effects, these do not look that great. But the problem with it is that they
for 92 they look all right, but post T2 they don't look all right.
Yeah, the thing with that was this movie was being shot and put together before T2 came out. So a lot of those developments, it's one of those victims of time, because it's like, oh shit, Terminator 2 comes out and it changes the way we look at movies. It's like anything that was still using kind of older special effects when The Matrix came out before it. It's like everything else is going to look bad in comparison. That said, I do admire some of the visual effects in the sense of it's a mixture of, well, first of all, it's a puppet, which I think is really cool. Right. It's not stop motion. Sometimes it looks really great. As the case with a lot of early CGI, it's very smooth, very bright, where it doesn't look natural. Like sometimes the alien's on the ceiling, and it literally looks like somebody just put like a poster of an alien cut and pasted in there. So I mean, it's no fault of their own, but that also kind of I think drags down this movie a little bit. Is the fact that the visual effects were at a time during transition, and they just mm-hmm. don't have aged very well, and that can hinder the film too, because you'll get some moments, including that iconic, I'm not gonna say face to face, but when the alien is mm-hmm. right next to Ripley, that iconic image, where it's clearly a puppet or a person in a suit, and it has that effect, but then it'll cut right to kind of this really bad, you know, visual of it coming up to Ripley. And so that doesn't help the film's legacy either. So there's a lot of things going against it, both historically and time-wise. So I think in a way, I end up appreciating the film more because there is competency here, despite all the stuff. I mean, we've seen films that have been messed with so much that they're incomprehensible or they're just terrible. This one,
they did their best. Yeah,
they did their best. Yeah, for sure.
They really did. And Fincher, and I know Fincher disowns it, but you can see his chops here. You know, that's a music video director who cuts for time. Love the movement POV camera and the tunnel fight and all that. Like that, I mean that sequence was nominated for like an MTV Movie Award for like best action sequence, and I can see why, because like that tunnel fight where they're just trying to outrun and chase and get him to the different places, and it's for Fincher to put all that together, get the actors in the move, cut that the whole thing together. There's still CGI and puppet combined. We always say on this show where as long as it's the blend of both helps the illusion, you know, because it's not all CGI, because then it'd be messier and you know, it'd be unconvincing to fight against, but it moves well. And that's one thing Fincher always shows out, is he's got a clean eye for a camera. He knows how to move things within a frame, and the editing. He can put those things together in a way that is, like you said, it never looks completely broken.
Well, I don't know how much got to say on the editing on this. I think he was locked out of the editing room, to be honest with you.
Chopping together a scene or two, and maybe this assembly cut using his nodes, it helps here a little bit. Where I'm seeing a better version, you know.
Well, the other thing I think you and I have discussed that we're not like Fincher heads. That like Fincher has the similar type of following that like a Nolan does or a Kubrick or whatever. He has that thing. What I will say is, for this being his first feature, I can see elements from this movie that exist all the way in The Killer from last year.
Oh, like, sure. Absolutely.
One thing I do admire about this movie a lot, and this is probably why, because Alien has the thrills of a horror film. Aliens has the pulse pounding action of an action film, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think what makes this one so tough for people is this is not a pleasant or enjoyable experience. And it's by design. What I love about this, and it's pure Fincher, is how basically nihilistic this movie is. I mean, this is why I don't mind Newton Hicks dying off screen. Because I think it adds to the tragedy of Ripley's existence. Oh, sure. And even characters that, you know, survive the worst fucking shit in this movie end up, you know, like there's the character of, what do they call him, 85? Because he's got the 85 IQ. Yeah. You know, like, you think he might be one of the first to die because he's incredibly stupid. But, you know, he makes it to the end, but then, you know, he stands up for Ripley and then gets shot. And you're just like, man, this guy made it through all these alien attacks and then he just gets fucking shot. Like, and then, just so many characters. Well, especially Clemens. I mean, Clemens just goes out. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where he's just talking and suddenly his head explodes and you're like, oh my God. Oh, yeah. Like, it's just, it's a bleak movie because our heroes that we're supposed to go for are either like corrupt prison wardens or former rapists and murderers. It's like there's really no one to really identify with. Even Dylan himself, you know, he kind of becomes a hero. He's kind of just like, hey, I'm a fucked up person. I'm just doing this religion thing so I can find some grace when I die, blah, blah, blah.
And that's Fincher kind of also like, let's punch down religion while I'm here too, you know?
Oh yeah, it's just a very bleak movie,
especially with corporate on the way just to take it over, you know. And there's no redeem. There's no, you're like you said, there's no good guy outside of Ripley. There's no backup, you know.
And I think a lot of people forget there is one character from Aliens who does get their moment before they die, and that's Bishop. Yeah. But that is so bleak too, because it's just he's trying to help. And like one thing I've always liked about the Alien movies is the androids kind of have they're very different from the typical robot or androids of things like Star Trek and stuff. They have emotions, they have feelings. There doesn't seem to be any kind of law of robotics in play. You know, they can't hurt people. Right. Yeah, there's just a moment where, like, he's trying to help Bishop out, and he's like, yeah, I he's like, I can't feel anything, man. You got to disconnect me. Just kill me. Like, I just, it's so bleak. It's just, everything's so bleak in this movie. And I think that's, this is not one you can just throw in the DVD player and watch.
Right.
You have to kind of be in the mood for, you have to kind of be ready for it, because it's just, and I'm always for, I don't believe, I mean, let's, if we're putting ourselves in 92, this is the conclusion to Ripley's story. Resurrection was years down the line. Yeah. We didn't know what was going to happen. And technically in that movie, it's not really Ripley anyway. So this is the
end of the Ripley trilogy.
As far as epilogues, I mean, a lot of people think everything should be like an end game, which is fine. That has its place.
Sure, sure. But
there's been stuff that has ended in a somber, slow manner. Like, one of the things that pops up in my head is the X-Files movie, the second one, that kind of functioned as a series finale, even though they eventually brought it back again. But it was very slow. It was very somber. It was very cerebral. You just kind of thought a lot. There wasn't a lot of pomp and circumstance. This one doesn't have,
right.
I mean, yes, there's some incredible action in it, but this one just feels kind of like a very low-key epilogue to a trilogy. It doesn't have the explosiveness of Aliens, but it to me, it has the emotional arc and narrative needed to close this character out. And I don't think a lot of people appreciate that, I guess.
I'll stand up and be one that does. And like I said, in my five, like that's pure Sigourney. You know, like she...
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't want to say knows this character as if she has to do homework, but I mean the idea that when as soon as you kind of present that she's got this embryo in her and that there's just an inevitable stake of like I'm screwed either way here, and yet I still, as the one character trying to do the right thing, or at least trying to save, you know, kill the aliens and to prevent worse coming out of her, worse going further. There's no good ending with that. And to see the assembly cut, you know, skip the chest bursting part for it really to be Ripley that dies instead of like the both that die. Like it's all packaged in there the right way to do it. And the heft of that moment for her to make the leap, so to speak, is built well. It peaks at the right spot. It screws over corporate, which is wonderful, and you need that sort of thing. And it is, but it is not I know it's a blaze of glory fall kind of thing, but it is a slow enough and small enough moment that's, you know, it's like Michael Corleone dying in his chair in the end of Godfather 3, where it's not exciting, you know, but it's just done. There's power to somber. It's a tough gear shift from like you said, from Aliens, but you can get there. And I think it also helps that there was enough years between Aliens and this to cleanse a palate, change, you know, mature an audience, step to a different era. You know, you're out of the excessive 80s. You don't need to do this commie Marxist stuff that showed up in the other five scripts that before this one, where they took a smart road. And even if that road is cold, it works for what they're trying to tell.
Yeah, I can't emphasize enough how much I love the fact that there's no weapons in this movie. Like,
That's a really cool touch.
I really love that. I think it's brilliant, especially because, like you said, one of those former scripts was another Marines thing, and that would have just been
overkill.
Terrible. And I've made this argument about the MCU when I've defended it, and I'll make it about the Alien things too. We're talking about Ripley. I mean, when I was thinking about this while I was rewatching Alien 3 and Resurrection for the podcast.
Yeah.
We really don't, much like the MCU, much like the Scream movies, they found a way to make it where there's some iconic villains.
Sure.
But in the end, it's still about the characters. Like in Scream, it's always going to be about Sidney and Dewey and all them. And in the MCU, like I said, it's not about the Iron Man suit. It's about Tony Stark underneath. This does the same thing. Like the poster doesn't need an alien, and I never sit down and think, man, that was a great alien sequence. Like I'm always just like, remember when Ripley did that or Ripley did this?
Yeah,
that's
really cool. Yeah,
that's a really hard thing to pull off when you have something so iconic like an alien.
Well, like we just saw it.
Xenomorph,
right. You know? We just saw this performed well this past award season. Look at Godzilla Minus One. Yep, you know,
exactly.
We're rooting for. Did you see what the pilot did? Did you see what the boat did? Like, did you see what she did? You know, like we have all these great human moments that just happen to have a big, tall, iconic villain looming over them, and obviously pushing the agenda, pushing the action, causing the destruction. Same thing with this movie here, where you're right. There's not as, other than maybe, like I said, that maybe that tallway chase a little bit in that action sequence, there's a couple of like, wow, what the alien do kind of thing. But no, you're hanging your hat and you're hanging your heart in this movie on the human mm-hmm. characters. And you're right. You've got criminals and not ne'er-do-wells in most of them. But when you've got Ripley, you're set. It's good.
So
another trait of this movie, I got to compliment. This might have my favorite score. Of the four movies we watch, I think Goldenthal bangs it. It's a good brassy score.
This is an amazing score. This is right. truly phenomenal. Like, it's been a long time. I mean, you know, I've seen these movies before, but and I've sure. always had a soft spot for the Resurrection. The only problem with Resurrection is it's a little repetitive.
Yes,
but but this one. I mean, I was so drawn in. Like, it's been a while since I've sat down and watched a movie where the score has just enveloped me. And like, I'm so yes. into, this is a fucking great score, man. This is so good. It's so good.
Cause it was, I know Goldsmith was, in the opening movie, Goldsmith is going for slight. I know he's a big brassy guy and it doesn't go, sure. go for the nuts. Was it Horner who did Aliens? I'm assuming with Cameron. Yes.
Yep.
Where Horner's strong and he makes good motifs and all that. But, but no, like Goldenthal comes in here with a fresh palette and a fresh movie and just bangs the brass, man. And he's good. And he would go on, of course, to do like Heat. He would do Batman Forever. Like, and that Batman Forever score, it has to come follow Elfman's, you know, amazing, yeah. you know, bold horn filled march. And he can. So like, I'm impressed with Goldenthal in this, where it's a step down by the time we make it to Resurrection next, but it hangs tight.
And I'll say barely a step down, because I think the Resurrection score is excellent. We'll talk about that next show. But you know, this one is probably the best of the series. My problem with James Horner's Alien score is it sounds very derivative of Wrath of Khan.
It almost
has the same exact cues in it.
And that's a Horner thing too. Horner, unfortunately, reuses two similar cues all the time. Like, you can listen to Braveheart, Apollo 13, Legends of the Fall, and a couple others, and you're like, wait a second, I've heard that flow before. And that, he's guilty of that in Titanic too, I should say. But that's Horner for you.
An Alien, Jerry Goldsmith, who I love, is probably my favorite film composer.
Oh,
he just kind of has that. In terms of memorable parts of that score,
yeah.
it's mostly just the doot, like the the little, but the rest of it is very incidental, and it's as a score should be. It's an underscore to what's happening in the movie. This one, though, really carries this picture at times, because you're just like, holy crap. Mixed with some of Fincher's images, I'm thinking of the opening 5 minutes, you know, where they find Ripley on the beach, and there's this very stark, you know, beach land and all these old oil refineries and stuff. And then, but also the scene where they're putting Hicks and Newt in the fire to basically, you know, cremate them or whatever. Just this, the images and the music. There's just so much going on in it. I'm glad you brought that up, 'cause that's great. But that can tie us into our assembly cut a little bit, because you watched the assembly cut as well. Yes,
I did. Yeah.
I am one of those people that, like, when a director says this is, or not, well, in this case, not the director, but somebody says this is the definitive version. Like, for example, like when I go to rewatch Blade Runner, I only watch either the director's cut or the final cut, depending on which one, because that's Ridley Scott saying that this is how I want it. You know, so and Lord of the Rings is the same thing. I'm not gonna watch the theatricals when I have the director's preferred extended cut version, right? This is the same thing.
We're going to be saying the same thing. We're going to be saying the same thing about Zack Snyder and Rebel Moon, won't we? Won't we? Oh,
God. Yeah,
can't wait. But
you know what? I may have never even seen the theatrical cut in full, to be honest.
Of Alien 3?
Yeah, because I was...
Yeah.
Even though I'm a big fan of these movies, I have to admit that, like I said, Alien, Aliens, and Alien Resurrection were kind of my jam. I don't even think I saw Alien 3 till I bought that quadrilogy set, and I immediately went to the assembly cut, because they said that's as close to Fincher as you're going to get, you know?
Yeah.
So I may have never even seen the theatrical version. If I have, it's been so long that I barely remember. The only major thing I remember, well, two things. One, and this is what I love about the assembly cut, is you get this subplot with this character of Golic. In the theatrical cut, Golic, he's kind of that crazy one that smells and has all the crazy teeth and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
In the
strapped to the table cut, in the infirmary for one scene. Right, right.
Right. In the theatrical cut, he just disappears. He never comes back. Like, and it's kind of like one of those things where everyone was like, when the movie came out, they're like, what happened to that guy? I mean, he wasn't important, but at the same time, it was like suddenly this character's there and then he's just gone. And you never see him die. You never see him on screen again after that infirmary scene. In the assembly cut, you find out, and this ties into another editing problem, you find out that he's the one who lets out the alien because he thinks it's like this dragon deity. He's the one who lets the alien out. Now, here's the other thing. Theatrical cut, they are unsuccessful in trapping the alien. But in the assembly cut, they are. So Golic letting the alien out creates this extra problem. It's kind of this extra thing that the movie has that I really appreciated. Whereas the theatrical cut, they don't successfully, all the explosions happen, they don't actually capture the alien, it's still loose. And I thought, and then they had nothing to do for that Golic character. So it's just kind of a weird cut thing. It just makes more sense in the assembly cut. But the other thing that doesn't make sense, but I still like it more, is in the theatrical cut, it's a dog.
I remember this.
The face hugger. In the assembly cut, it's an ox. Now, I understand visually it just looks more interesting to have the ox. And that scene is much better than like seeing a dog like keel over like the thing and die or something. The way that it's directed in the assembly cut where like they bring the ox in and they're just talking about dying. And then the guy finds the queen face hugger and you're like, oh, shit. However, the alien itself is still dog-like. There's no ox-like qualities to that fucking thing. It's just a...
Can you imagine a thin-legged hoofed alien xenomorph? So,
So while it is visually evocative, like bringing in that huge ox corpse and having the thing come out of the ox's body, it doesn't make any sense
That's true.
It's not a dog. You know what I mean? And actually, I think there's that scene in the guy. I never know what this guy's doing, but there's the guy who's like cleaning the pipes or something. And I guess they probably replaced some lyrics or lyrics. They probably replaced some dialogue here. But in the theatrical
cut, So
In the theatrical cut, remember he sees that hole in the vent or whatever, and he thinks it's the dog. That's why he's going in there, because otherwise why the hell would you go in there? Because that's Prometheus level stupidity. So it makes sense that the guy goes in there because he's like, oh, there's the dog. But in the assembly cut, he's looking in there for no reason whatsoever, and then the alien kills him. So there's definitely some things with the assembly cut that do not make sense. They just look more interesting, but on a whole, I would say the assembly cut is the way to go.
I agree. I'll trade little coherency like you're talking about for good looks. It does help that it sounds like the Blu-ray version of it got like the color correction and some better sound mixing to match the rest of the film versus that first DVD release that you probably saw where it felt a little, you know, felt a little stitched together, a little like, oh, you can see the breaks and you can see where these new extended cuts and pieces would come in. And it sounds like they brought some actors in to re-record some dialogue, which is always kind of handy. So that's cool. I'm glad I got to see its best version. And honestly, and it's okay. And I'm glad Fincher isn't Cameron and isn't Lucas or Coppola, where you need to cut. I'm happy he doesn't have the desire to come back in and really, really, really fix it. Yeah, it's been 30 years. His career has gone further. He's got other things he's doing. If it's some old man someday, if he wants to come back and do this, fine. But, you know, like, this can be just exactly what it is. And I know, obviously, the character, you know, the franchise and the properties kept going where, with it being under Disney's umbrella now, technically, I don't even know if they would ever open up that can of worms to be like, hey, David, you know, it's been 35 years or 40 years. You want to give this another look? And if he's like, no, I'd be completely fine with that. Unlike Scott and everybody who wants to tinker forever. So.
Yeah. And Scott, even though I don't think he ever really redid Alien, he kind of got to redo it with Prometheus, which I think is a disaster, but we'll talk about that some other day. But
that's right.
Yeah, I think the assembly cut is the way to go. I definitely, I don't want to say don't watch this movie, or I think it gets better with time.
I think so too.
You're separated from the culturalness. You're separated from the culturalness of Alien being in the, you know, being in the cultural consciousness, you know. And, I think it's better with time, personally.
I agree. And for me, what will always keep it strong and unique and worth watching is you're talking about it. This is Ripley's end, Ripley's actual end, not just the cute resurrection we're going to get in another movie, but like to watch Sigourney Weaver take this character, put it in this setting, put no guns in there, like you said, and she insisted. You get the most out of her as an actress at a time where she, like you opened the show and said, she was at her peak, and she's coming out here with, you know, the tough haircut and the good look, and she carries this movie on her back. And that to me is worth watching, and because again, compared to the things we watch today of just so low stakes, so predictable characterizations, you have an actress and a character that's willing to roll with and create and tackle challenges. And I'll take that to, you know, one note characterizations that we have too much of today. So you want a full bodied character going through all kinds of shit. It's her every single time. And we get a funner, weirder version of where she's going through the next one too. And even that's got a zillion miles of depth, which is fun to see. So we got a good one next. So
yeah, I think now you, what'd you rate this in the end?
I did 3 out of 5. And I don't know if you've seen the Facebook discussion today when I posted that. Apparently I'm high in terms of like being 3 instead of 2 or 1. I would never give this a 2 or a 1. I watched a solid movie that kept my attention the whole time. I'm seeing Baby Fincher make some moves, and I'm seeing Sigourney Weaver own the place. So yeah, I was never
going to. You know me with my halves. I gave it 3.5.
Okay.
So, I mean, we're virtually the same.
Pretty much,
It's kind of that half is kind of an appreciation. Because I think 3 for me is always kind of like, it was good. And I think there's elements of this that are more than good. But not like 4-star level. But yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, I'm not going to rush back to watch it anytime soon because it's so bleak and different. It's definitely I would say a misunderstood and underappreciated little film, you know, that I think deserves a little bit of, hopefully maybe people listen to this who haven't seen it in a long time, or maybe haven't even seen it at all, will pick it back up and say, hey, we're going to watch this. Cause I think it deserves to be seen. It definitely deserves to be seen. And for those that lament, you know, franchise filmmaking these days, this one and the one we're talking about next week really took some steps to change how things are done in a franchise, and people didn't like it anyway. So you really can't make anybody happy, I guess, is what we're kind of, you know, I guess what we're kind of discovering is no one's happy with anything, which is kind of a bummer. So
And I get I came into it doing the whole Newton Hicks thing where I know you're not going to please everybody, but can you still, you know, comport yourself and present yourself with something challenging, something worthwhile to watch. And this is still that. And I hope people do what you're saying, you know, a critic reappraisal of it. Go find that assembly cut, you know, which seems to be the accepted way it's out there. It is streaming on Hulu. I assume it's the theatrical. On Hulu, so you're gonna have to be a physical media person and come find the assembly cut. And as we say on this show, physical media is worth it every time. So
it's been renamed the special edition, just like everything else. So originally there was a Aliens director's cut. Now it's called the special edition. Resurrection actually has a director's cut also.
I watched that.
That has like a different alternate opening and stuff like that. That's also now called the special edition. So if you go to buy these on DVD, Blu-ray, whatever, if it says special edition, you're getting the assembly cut, I believe.
I think in that
package. Cool. But also, hopefully,
for those people who are looking at numbers, look for 144 minutes for this one. That's the spot of Alien 3 here. Yeah.
Well, also, and I can't emphasize enough, and this should be on the DVDs too, I would hope, is the making of documentary of this, which is essentially 3 hours. I think it's called, I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head. I think it's called like wreckage and
sure
wreckage in space or some shit, but it's amazing because I mean they got
that's another thing. Yeah. That's another thing I miss is expansive behind the scenes production featurettes on because yeah. like I've been getting a lot of Warner Brothers discs. You see me get my Warner Brothers discs and all this stuff like that. Yep. The production like featurettes on these things nowadays are like 7, 10, maybe 15 minutes, and it's all cut in the background where it's the people who are talking in chairs who are voicing scenes and talking their little scripted things, what they want to say happened in the movie, cut, you know, combined with just a montage of recorded visuals happening in the background where it's not live audio from the set and anything like that. It's just a montage fest of making ofs and not drilling in, talking to people and seeing the ins and outs and nuts and bolts. I miss docs like that. Like Abyss has a great one. This one sounds amazing when you're saying 3 hours. That's yes, awesome.
It's the official name is Wreckage and Rage Making Alien 3. It's 161 minutes.
Wow.
Everyone except Fincher is in this. I mean, they That's interview amazing. Everybody. Not only do they interview the people that were in the movie and were directly making it, they interview like Rennie Harlan, for example, his involvement.
That's cool.
They interview all the original screenwriters.
That's cool.
They do the special effects parts. They show you that time lapse footage of the sets being built. Like it's every aspect of how the film is made. And I've only seen it once back in that day.
But yeah,
I still remember almost every part of it. It's that impactful of a documentary, and also it helps, a la like Hearts of Darkness, The Making of Apocalypse Now, and movies that have all this stuff going on. It also helps that, you know, if this movie was plagued with problems, it creates a lot of drama for you to watch on behind the scenes. So I would highly recommend if you get a chance. I was unable to find it like online anywhere, not even on YouTube. I think maybe the first hour is on YouTube. If you can,
I assume it's a disc only situation there. Yeah,
it might be. If you can watch Wreckage and Rage, I highly recommend it. In some cases, it might even be better than the movie, but those were the days, man, when you would get those.
Hey, physical media, it surpasses what we can do now. It's great.
It's this and the audio commentaries have gone the way of the dodo. So
I know. I haven't seen the disc this far. I did, but I went digital, so you know me. So sneaky.
No, I know, but I just saw it says you have a rating on it on Letterboxd.
Oh, for Wreckage, I might have been clicking too fast. That's my fault. But I did not see Wreckage. I need to. So are there any, what are the commentaries on this quadrilogy disc for Alien 3?
When we eventually do Prometheus, we'll talk about it because, I'll just tell you right now real quick because we got a couple minutes. But, it's the most frustrating commentary because first of all, it's one of those Alien commentaries.
3. Okay.
No, Alien, the first one.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So the first one is really frustrating because it's one of those commentaries where you could tell like they filmed a commentary or they recorded a commentary with like four different groups and then decided to edit it together. Like,
parts,
which is annoying because then you'll like be getting into a conversation with someone and then suddenly it'll just cut to the next one. Now, So Sigourney Weaver and Ridley Scott are together on their parts.
Ooh.
And during Alien, he talks about all the shit he wants to do. And you can tell, fucking Sigourney Weaver sitting there like, this is so fucking stupid. Don't do this. Please, dear God. And then, because that quadrilogy came out in
03, if I remember correctly.
Something like that. It was 03, 04, because I remember showing this to a girlfriend at the time. I was like, let's watch all of these.
It's a beautiful box. Fox knew what they were doing making DVDs. Great menus. They had the best.
But eventually, if that was 03, I guess 10 years later he made Prometheus and did everything he said in that commentary, and that's why the movie sucks. If you can find that set, I'm sure you can get it on eBay or something. It's worth getting. I mean, I'm sure the video quality is not as great as you can get now, but I don't care about that kind of stuff. So, to me, it's about the having access to all the different cuts, having commentaries, having those behind the scenes things, because Alien has been surprisingly very open. I mean, because the Resurrection one is excellent too. It's not 3 hours, but it's maybe an hour and a half, and it goes through all the details and
better than 15 minutes. Yeah,
yeah. No, it's that's got to be an all time set, man. That's got to be an all time physical quadrilogy box that I wish I never gave up. You know, but I did.
They might make a 4K one by this point. I gotta look that up next. But closing thoughts on that.
There is one called the Alien Anthology, which I think is the original four, but it you know, you open it, it's the discs are big, you know, the discs have more space. So it's not the same as opening up that quadrilogy and it was like 7 feet long, you know. You were like, holy crap.
Yeah.
Anyways, final thoughts. I would just say watch it with an open mind. Don't watch it with expecting aliens. You should never watch any of the original four Alien movies expecting the same thing ever, because I think it's one of the most unique series in terms of unique directorial voices, great performances, great actors that cover all kinds of ranges of stuff, from space truckers to Marines to lifers in prison. Like there's so much good stuff going on. There's way too much good stuff in Alien 3 to pass up. Don't listen to the hype. Make your own opinions. Give it a try. I think it's pretty awesome.
Cool. Well, thanks as always for just pushing us down this road of this rewatch and this reassessment of the series. Three down, one to go.
Hell yeah, man!
Wow, we'll hop into Covenant for, like you said, Covenant and Prometheus to slam a few doors and see what we can do there too.
And I promise you, we will not be covering any of the Alien vs. Predator movies. That is a promise.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Because those suck very badly. All right, folks, we now have merch, from shirts to stickers. Find some sweet cinephile hissy fit swag on TeePublic, TeePublic.com/user/Ruminations Radio Network. Follow us on Twitter at Cinephile Fit, on Facebook at Cinephile Hissy Fit Podcast, and Instagram at Cinephile Fits. Find both of us by name on Letterboxd to check out our film reviews and ratings. We are also on Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you so much for your loyal listenership and our tussles, and for connecting with us on social media. Cinephile Hissy Fit is a Ruminations Radio Network podcast sponsored by Film Obsessive. If you enjoyed this show, the Ruminations Radio Network has more excellent programming with stellar hosts and spirited topics. Please rate, review, and subscribe to our show and others on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you find your favorite podcasts.